the levels of lead in children's blood have gone down significantly in recent years. So move to Trail.
Welcome to Keep It Fictional, a weekly podcast for book lovers by book lovers. Build your to-be-read list with Sadie, Liz, Virginia, Fiona, and Corrine from the Port Moody Public Library. Warning, this podcast contains strong opinions and may cause an increase in your library holds list.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Keep It Fictional from the Port Moody Public Library. I am Sadie, and I'll be your host today. And I am joined today by my book friends, Corrine, Virginia, and we are welcoming back Liz for today's episode. Welcome back, Liz, and hello to all of our book friends today. Now, for today's episode, we are actually going to be giving a bit of a nod to one of our past book friends, our wonderful CanCon advocate, Fiona. And that is because coming up on November 8th, it is I Read Canadian Day. A little bit of background for anyone who is not familiar with or aware of what this day is. I Read Canadian Day is a national celebration of Canadian books for young people. Now, the goal of I Read Canadian Day is to elevate the genre of Canadian books for young people and to celebrate the breadth and diversity of these books. As I mentioned, this year's event is taking place on November 8th. And schools, libraries, daycares, families, everyone across Canada is invited to join in with reading, being read to, or listening to a Canadian book for at least 15 minutes that day. So for today's episode, we are going to be bringing you four books by Canadian authors to provide you with maybe some suggestions or inspiration for your I Read Canadian Day reading or just for your reading throughout the year. Because as we always like to mention, you do not have to just read Canadian books on this one day. We encourage you to read Canadian year round. All right. So we are going to start off today with Virginia. Virginia, which Canadian book will you be talking about?
So my book for today is Do You Remember Being Born by Shawn Michaels. You may know Shawn Michaels from his book Us Conductors, which is a Giller Prize winner. And this is their latest book. And I decided to pick this one up because I'm interested to see how this author deals with the very timely topic of generative AI, specifically in the area of writing and creating art. During the times these days when we have authors who found books that are on sale online that are attributed to them when they have never wrote them before, or authors that are suing companies for using their work to train AI, I'm looking forward to a thought-provoking, hopefully, exploration of the topic. You know, maybe some opinions about, does it have to be a human to write a story? Can a machine do it? And just want to say for all those non-science fiction fans out there, this is not science fiction, even though I'm the person talking about it. So don't worry. It is a very human-centered contemporary fiction with our protagonist, Marian Farmer, who is based on real-life American poet Marianne Moore. And that's a little bit more connection to this real person that I'll tell you about later. Now, Marian Farmer has had a very successful writing career. She's a poet, and anybody who reads poetry will know her for sure, especially with her signature tricorn hat. She's always been a very private person, and now that she's a bit older, she doesn't really produce as much poetry. She's even a bit more secluded. Despite her writing career, she is feeling quite inadequate when the book opens. Her son Courtney and his partner would like to buy a place, but she has no money to give them. She can't help them out. She can't support them. And she feels really, really bad about it. But a letter came in that day in the mail that may save the day. This letter came very unexpectedly from one of the biggest tech companies right now. They have a proposal for Marian. They would like to fly her to San Francisco, all expenses paid, of course. And there, they would like her to spend a week in the headquarters, writing a poem for them. A long poem, they said, which she found out later that means 6 pages minimum. But she won't be writing this poem alone. She will be collaborating with their poetry AI. this will be the first ever poem written by a human and a machine together. And they are, of course, going to get her into some of the biggest talk shows to promote this. They have a special ceremony and reading plan already with a very, very exclusive group of guests. And of course, the poem will be published everywhere, online and in physical formats. Marianne knows that if she agrees to this, she will likely be remembered forever and ever as that first poet to write a poem with a machine. It doesn't even really matter what she's written before. But she can really use the money because they are promising her an obscene amount of money to do this collaboration. And Marianne is also quite curious. I mean, she's not like super into tech, but she's definitely not afraid of it. And she kind of wants to know what this experience of writing a poem together with someone is like. Not just someone, but a machine. So she agreed to do this. And this is how she meets Charlotte, the poetry writing AI. And as we spend the week with Marianne and Charlotte, as they get to know each other and they write the poem together, we also get taken back through chapters that are titled Hindsights to learn more about Marianne's life up to this point. How she started writing, how she became a poet, how she met her husband Larry, how they raised their child Courtney together. And we learn about her struggles to try to reconcile those forces that are pulling her apart, the pressure to create, the pressure to write, versus the pressure to fulfill her obligations, her responsibilities as a mother, as a wife, as a woman in the society. And we get a sense that behind that relatively strong kind of appearance of Marianne, there's that self-doubt, feeling maybe a bit of regret and shame of the choices that she has made, always making her feel like she has failed, that she has failed her writing, she has failed her family, and often feeling like she has failed both. And going back and forth between the past and the present, we may perhaps see sort of one possible answer to that question, like whether you need a human to write a story. But Marianne is also kind of thinking, well, what if you can write like Charlotte, the AI? What if you can fully participate and completely give in to that one purpose of yours, to write poetry like Charlotte? What would that be like when you're unburdened and free from that human experience? Now, Shawn Michaels started writing this book 3 years ago. So that's before ChatGPT became like a household name. And the book, so is kind of like before its time in many ways. And what's unique about this book is that Shawn Michaels, along with a programmer, actually created and trained an AI based on Marianne Moore's poetry, among others. This is the Moore bot that he called it. And he wrote with this AI, and he included some of that writing in the book. The book has bits and pieces that are highlighted in the text. Those are the parts that actually the AI wrote. And he has incorporated that into the book, which makes, of course, a very unique kind of experience, not just for him as a writer, but also for us as a reader. Of course, the question being raised as Shawn Michaels is thinking about all this and doing this is that, like, how much of what I put on the page is intentional? Did I purposely, consciously choose this word over the other? Or does it just like came to me and I just wrote it down? It kind of reminds me of my high school English teacher when she told us that she went to see Timothy Finley at the Vancouver's Writer Festival. And there's like some really big fans in the audience, and maybe not so much like the trackies, but like they're still like, oh, on this page, why did you do this kind of thing? And Timothy Finley's answer is basically like, I don't know. And that's kind of how like Shawn Michaels are kind of thinking, like, how much of it is like, is it a conscious choice that I'm making here every time I pick up that pen? And what does it mean when a machine can learn patterns, can learn your preferred diction and word order and learn frequency of words, learn like proximity of words, what words kind of stay together frequently for this particular author? And what does it mean when it can arrive at sort of that style based on what they've been trained on? There's so many interesting questions that are being explored in this book. And I really appreciate that it's done with a very open mind. And that really makes a much, I think, a better look at this whole idea of generative AI in writing or in creating art. So it's a book for anybody who is interested in the topic, give you a writer, give you an artist, give you any kind of creator to look at how this technology may change and impact your creative process. And of course, not to understate that very, very character-driven story. I think Marion's experience and her voice really is what carries the book through. So if you are looking for a book, and that's my Fiona's connection here, if you're looking for a book with an older adult as a protagonist, which Fiona loves, this might be a book for you. So many, many reasons to pick up this book. So this is, again, Do You Remember Being Born by Shawn Michaels.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Virginia. Yeah, AI is something that that kind of terrifies me. I'm not going to lie. It's something that's, yeah, I think it's on all of our minds, I'm sure. And I think we are starting to see more of an impact. I mean, the current actors' strike in the States right now, I think, is quite heavily impacted by AI. And I'm sure that will start to come up more and more in other creative industries as well. So thank you for bringing that book forward. All right. Next, we are going to go to Liz. Liz, what book have you brought for us today?
Well, hi, everybody. Nice to be back. Did you all miss me? Don't answer that. That's just, I don't need to know that. So I am here today for I Read Canadian Day with one of my, I think, now favorite authors. They haven't written a lot of books, but I really enjoyed their first book. Now, that author is Lindsay Wong, and the book that I'll be talking about today is Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality. And I just realized, hey, Fiona, if you're listening, mushrooms on the cover. This might be right up your alley, but I'll tell you about it and you can let me know later whether it is. So as you may or may not know, Lindsay Wong is the author also of The Woo-Woo, How I Survived Ice Hockey, Drug Raids, Demons, and My Crazy Chinese Family. Now, that book was about growing up in a household that explained away its misfortunes, some tied to mental illness, being caused by ghosts, which is The Woo-Woo. This particular book, Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality, is billed as a wild and darkly hilarious collection of immigrant horror stories. Sounds amazing to me. Sign me up. Well, Wong goes all in with this fictional exploration of supernatural phenomena, with everything from ghosts and demons to lizard women and birdmen. Now, in the titular story, the unnamed 376-year-old woman is once again being feted at the Death-Eating Flower Festival, which is more of a survivalist game show at this point than a celebration. So for a fee of 10 million Chinese yuan, which is approximately, according to my calculations recently, about 1.9 million Canadian dollars, participants have purchased the opportunity to ingest what is known as the Night Blooming Death Lily. It is a highly toxic plant purported to give its ingestees that immortality. However, in the whole known history of this plant, the only known survivor of this poison has been this 376-year-old woman. And yet they have so many people, rich people, wanting to sign up to try this out in the hopes that they will be immortal. Very strangely enough, though, everybody participating seems to have overlooked how the old woman's hair is thinned. Her skin is flaking with every movement. And also the odd appendage will just snap right off like a biscuit. You know, if she moves the wrong way, stubs her toe, takes her shoe off. What is up with that? So at this point, don't want to give away what exactly happens at the current Death-Eating Flower Festival. But if you are interested, you'll just have to pick up this book. In the story, Wreck Beach, Wong continues to infuse yet another story with some local lower mainland flavor. Yes, it is that Wreck Beach, the spot popular with nudists near the University of British Columbia. Now, our story opens with yet another Find Daddy Night. So the teenage girl's immigrant mother, single after her husband disappeared without a trace one day, has asked the daughter to feign some serious symptoms in an effort to snag a well-off physician for their family. Is that abusive? Is that weird? I'll leave that up to you. Anyways, is the girl's father really gone? She swears she can see him sometimes in the eyes of a crow that happens to perch on their windowsill from time to time. Anyways, the rest of the time when she's not at the hospital, she is a latchkey kid. She's left to spend much of her time with another boy in a similar situation whose mother also works long hours. Now they're in grade 12 and he has decided to take his girlfriend to the grade 12 grad party. Makes sense, right? However, our protagonist is dismayed by this. After spending so much time with him, she has a bit of a crush on him. Or maybe a bit more than a crush, as we will see. After the party, the group heads out to the infamous wreck beach, and some dark things happen. Now, in Red Tongue Ghosts, a family relegated to the undead tries to find interesting ways to fill their unending days. What do you do when you're living forever but not really living? Fortunately, they are located near the Baekdu Mountain Hot Springs, aka the Very Hot Suicide Spring, in the Changbai Mountains. You kind of see a theme going through the book here. So tourists pay loads of money to scald themselves in the sulfuric waters of these hot springs, with the unwelcome feature of finding out that the resort is haunted. Now, one day, an emergency ghost family meeting is called. The resort owners are bringing in psychics and ghost hunters to film a documentary and hopefully rid the place of the hauntings. So whatever will happen to these ghosts who are undead, but apparently have a mission to haunt this hot spring. Anyway, these are just a few of the bizarre, charming, funny, darkly funny, horrific stories that you will find in this book. I thoroughly enjoyed this one and was really, really, really surprised by how each of the stories that I read were just note perfect. Every single one, I couldn't find one in the bunch that I did not like. So again, that's Tell Me Pleasant Things About Immortality by Lindsay Wong.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Liz. It's great to have that Fiona connection and also to bring it back with a very Liz book today. I feel like that is a very, very Liz book. So thank you for returning and for representing some wonderful CanCon stories today. All right. It is time for our existential question. I'm going to pose a truly horrible existential question to my book friends in the form of a would you rather question. So listeners, I invite you to play along with us in this truly horrible would you rather question. And this is all about how you mark your spot in a book when you are reading. So book friends, I ask you, would you rather always have to mark your spot by dog-earing the corner of your book or by making a little mark with a pen on the page where you have left off?
I was hoping you would forget about the with a pen part. And then I can just say like, we'll just make a light pencil mark or whatever. But I think I would still pick a tiny little, because I can do really tiny little dot. And I would just blend it in somehow with the letters or something so that like I won't see it. Because folding it, that's done. Like you can never unfold it. But the tiny little dot, if I just blend it in with the page number or something, I think I can make that work.
Isn't the point to see it though, so you can mark your page and return to the page?
Yeah, but I will see it. I will see it, Liz. You know that. You know that I will see that dot no matter what.
Your eyesight is so keen. So keen. Yeah, I'm going to have to disagree with Virginia to no one's surprise. I don't write in books ever. Ever. I have a collection of Daiso stationery that I can put my little post-it notes if there's something important, which is, I feel like, the best way. I'm always at least 5 feet within the proximity of a post-it note in my entire life. So I'm actually going to go with dog earring, which I don't love. I don't love, but I feel like, you know, sometimes when you get a secondhand book and you see that like several pages have been dog-eared and you're like, oh, there was the reader before me that has like imbued a bit of themselves and changed the book, because to be loved is to be changed. So that's fine. It's fine. That's what I'm going with.
I'm going to have to actually agree with Corrine about the dog-earing of the book. Virginia, hear me out. Okay. As a child, borrowing books from the library, I used to really love picking up those paper bags and the spines would be worn. No more, but as a child, I was like, this is so great. This book has history. This book has been through things. It's seen things. Now I am going through stuff with this book. It's so well loved. Like, hey, look at us reading. I may have dog-eared some pages of books that, you know, that were already in that situation. I mean, no longer, but if I had to pick something, it'd be that.
I don't believe you, this no longer part.
Sadie, is this all just a ploy to get us to like confess our library sins?
I was actually going to say, I was reading one of the book club books the other day from our social justice book club sets, and one of them had been dog-eared, and I was like appalled when I saw it. So I'm going to balance things out here, and I'm going to say a little tiny mark on the page as well. And I'm the same. Like I do not write in books. I am a very strong bookmark person. and so, yeah, but I'm going to say a little tiny mark because once it's folded, it's just can't be unfolded.
The same logic is for the pen, Sadie. Once it's written, it cannot be unwritten.
I know, but it's so tiny. You can make it so tiny. I guess I have to ask my dog ear people, are you like, how much of the page are you folding? Are you committing to the full?
I'm not origamiing it, Sadie. Like there.
Well, no, but like just like the tiny corner or like that much.
There is the perfect dog earring. Like there's, you just do like. Oh, yeah. Observe this. It's here. It's right there. Because then you can see it from the outside of the book. Otherwise, like, why are you putting a quitter stick in it? Like, just...
Because you have a child and have no time to read.
Fine.
All right. Well, before things get too heated and... We are going to move on. So I am going to talk about my book for today's episode. And the book that I'm going to talk about, I was actually drawn to because of its location. And I'll explain a little bit more about that after I tell you about the book itself. The book I'm going to be talking about is called Poison Town. And it's by Alyssa Campbell, and it is her debut novel. It is a YA book, and it's quite a short book. It's only about 106 pages long, just over 100 pages. So if you are looking for a quick read, this would definitely be a good one. And this book follows 14-year-old Addie Woods. Addie is in the principal's office again. However, it's only the second time since she'd moved to this town last year. So really, it's not so bad. Especially compared to her brother, Jamie, whose name in the records are accompanied by numerous red X's for tardiness, missed homework assignments, and other unexplained absences. So really, Addie is actually doing pretty good. Now, Addie and her family had left Vancouver just over a year ago for her father's work, and they settled into this small town in the interior of BC. Nestled in the mountains and along a river, the town at first seemed like a paradise. It was beautiful, and it was really an idyllic escape from the fast-paced big city. And honestly, since she'd been here, Addie had been granted so much freedom that she almost wasn't sure how to handle it. However, there was one thing that made sure this town was not, in fact, a paradise, and that was the lead and zinc smelter. The smelter had sat up on the hill above the town and had been a constant there since the early 1900s. The smelter, which was the reason that her family had moved in the first place. Addie knew that her mother hadn't really wanted to move, but the job was too good for her dad to pass up. And he assured Addie's mom that the smelter had done a lot in the last 20 years to clean up its operations and lessen the effect on the town and its inhabitants. So they moved. And now Addie is back in Principal Sox's office, having to explain that she hadn't filled Priya's locker with insects. She had simply put one earthworm inside of it because Priya had called her dumb. Now, Addie's life is made even more challenging by the fact that Priya's dad is her dad's boss. And even more challenging when her and Priya are paired together for a science project. Addie is dreading having to work with Priya, and she honestly has no idea how they're ever going to agree on what their project is going to be on. However, Addie is a little surprised when she finds that her and Priya actually have something in common, and that is the connection of their dads and their dad's jobs. They both work for the lead and zinc smelter, and they both work in the safety department, which has been tasked with ensuring that emissions that are coming out of the smelter are kept at safe levels for the community. Now, back in the 1990s, there had been a report that was done by UBC that exposed extremely high and unsafe levels of lead in the land and the water that was surrounding the smelter. This is the land and the water of the town itself. And Addy was very interested in this study and very interested in what exactly had been done to ensure that these levels were no longer dangerous. So Addy decides that this is what their project will be on. Now, because Addy isn't sure that the promises that the smelter made are actually being followed through on, she's noticed a couple things. Yellow rings around the puddles on the street. Birds that fall from the sky dead for apparently no reason. And her brother Jamie's asthma, that had pretty much all but disappeared, has now suddenly returned, causing him to have to drop out of pretty much every form of physical activity, which he absolutely loves. So Addy decides to start investigating the smelter to try and figure out what exactly is happening in this town. However, as she pushes through with her investigation, she finds that not everyone is super supportive of this investigation, including her project partner, Priya, Priya's dad, her own dad, and the person that she actually thought she'd get support from, her brother, Jamie. So I was drawn to this book because I grew up very close to a smelter town. And when I first read the description, I was really curious whether the town in this book was actually inspired by the town that I know really well, Trail, BC. I remember hearing on the radio when I was in high school a promotional ad for Trail, trying to convince people to move there. And it would say that the levels of lead in children's blood have gone down significantly in recent years. So move to Trail. So as it turns out, yes, this book is inspired by Trail, BC, among other towns in BC that have smelters in them or close to them. But this book, I suppose the author's dad grew up in Trail. And as soon as you start reading it, it is very obvious that this book is about Trail, BC. And she says that at the end of the book as well. So that was sort of my initial connection to this book and why I wanted to read this book. It is, as I said, it's a very quick read. It doesn't go super in depth into sort of the mystery aspect of it. It does have a little bit of a mystery, a little bit of an investigation. Addy is kind of a fun character that you get to follow along with. But if you are kind of looking for something that's a little bit more lighthearted, it does, for the most part, wrap everything up at the end in a nice little bow. The author was very clear to say that the report done by UBC was actually followed in Trail, BC. So they did actually take the appropriate steps to ensure the safety of the town. But it was for me, it was a very interesting book to read, just being so familiar with the town and being so familiar with what that history had been. The smelter there has been quite a controversial topic for many, many years, as it provides a lot of jobs for a lot of people, but the danger of it is also very high. So yeah, so if you are looking for something that's a very quick and easy read, that is a YA book, has a fun kind of character to follow and a bit of an investigation, if you're interested in smelters and what impacts they have on the environment, it has a very strong kind of environmental focus to this book. Addy kind of takes on the role of environmental advocate in this book. So if that's interesting to you as well, then I would recommend Poison Town by Alyssa. For our final book today, we will be going over to Corinne. Corinne, did you pick a Fiona-focused book today or some other sort of CanCon?
I feel like Fiona actually would appreciate this book if they haven't already read it, because it does concern like sadness and old ladies and like memory. And then I don't think there are any mushrooms in it, but there is like art. So I feel like Fiona would appreciate it if they haven't already read it. This book kind of reminds me of something from my childhood where my family, our parents enrolled us all in swim club. And, you know, obviously as a born athlete, I loved it so much. And part of being part of the swim club was that you had to drive through endless stretches of wilderness from one small town to another small town every weekend for swim meets. And I distinctly remember one of these very long, very early drives. And in between towns, there's not a lot there. There's farmland. And then as the arrogant worm song goes, there are rocks and trees and trees and rocks and rocks and trees and rocks and rocks and trees and trees and water. And then all of a sudden, in between this like long stretch of forest, there was a clearing. And I got a glimpse of, in the middle of this forest, in the middle of nothing, with nothing around it, this beautiful silver onion-domed church, beautifully, meticulously built out of wood and stone, and that beautiful kind of rounded top with the like the Orthodox cross on top, in the middle of nothingness. And it almost seemed like a glimpse into another world. And when I saw it, I started to think, like, who built this and why here? Why here, of all places in northern Alberta, would you build something so beautiful and so remote? And that idea of the church in the wilderness is the impetus of the story of a Canlit classic, The Stone Carvers by Jane Urquhart, which again, I do think that Fiona would appreciate. And it does begin with this idea, this obsession of a church in the wilderness. So it starts with Father Gestir, G-N-S-T together. So that's a rough one for me, Gestir, who is sent from Bavaria into kind of northern Ontario to kind of minister to the German Catholic population there. He's sent to a very isolated town of Schönwall. And when he arrives there, he realizes that his old life is over and his new life is beginning. And he is obsessed with the idea of making a mark on this town, something permanent to stand there. And so he enlists the help of a local master carver, Joseph Becker, to help him build this proper church with a beautiful church bell in the middle of this nothingness. And so this story follows the story of Joseph, the carver who builds something from nothing, and his family through three generations. We get his story, and we get the story of his grandchildren, Clara and Tillman. Now, Joseph, as a grandfather, wants to pass on his skills, the skills that he learned in Germany, the skills of a master carver, to his grandson. But Tillman is not like the stone. He is not permanent. He cannot stay in one place. He is like water and he wants to run away. He's a boy filled with wanderlust, much to the despair of his family, who take extreme measures to keep him in one place, including tying him to the ground to stop him from running away. Unfortunately, the other child is a daughter. And Clara, when we see her in the present in one of the stories, is a spinster living in this small town, but she carries a secret. In that, in addition to learning needlecraft from her mother, she learned stone carving from her grandfather. This follows the story of these three individuals as they grow up and their lives are interrupted by greater world events and tragedies. All of their lives and their skills and their stories come to bear after the Great War and in their survival after the Great War. This book talks about the war memorial at Vimy, France, and the people who carved it and why. It's a book about remembrance and memorialization and memory and history and the generational stories that we tell. It's a story of kind of lost love and what that means and the remembrance of people. This was published in 2001. It was a finalist for the Giller Prize, the Governor General Award, longlisted for the Booker Prize. It's one of those like classic Canlits that probably people here or people listening to had to write an essay about in high school. And Controversially, I think it actually deserves to be. I always associate a lot of canlit with crying because, Liz, you make a face, but they're always sad. They're always sad. One of the very first like adult books that I read far too early and didn't really understand what was going on was Margaret Lawrence's The Diviners, which was a real choice, which I bawled at. Or like Carol Shields's The Stone Diaries, which I bawled at, and The Stone Carvers, which I read a long time ago, and I bawled at. So it really is like, it's an old one, and I like, you know, and Keep It Fictional, we do the new stuff, but we also do the backlist stuff, that this is actually like worth a read, even now. I think that sometimes you have to go back to the classics to see if they still deserve to be there. And this is one that does, arguably. And I think I have argued right here that it does. So if you are wanting to celebrate, what is it? Keep It Canadian? CanCon? Canadiana. I read Canadian for 15 minutes a day. If you are looking to get your 15-minute fix, or perhaps longer or shorter, I guess, you can definitely pick up one of these lovely classics with that like very distinctive spine that all of these books published by McClellan and Stewart had for these kind of like Canadian classics. Every time I see this spine, I'm just like immediately thrown back into exactly what kind of book I'm going to read. And so I would heartily recommend maybe like taking a look back at kind of like the great writers and picking up a classic.
Wonderful. Thank you, Corinne. I have not read The Stone Carvers, but it weirdly sounds very similar, not in all parts of it, but to Pillars of the Earth. Just the idea of significantly shorter, and it probably would not be a 41-hour audiobook. But just kind of the idea of it focusing on that kind of master stone carver and his family and building of a church. And yeah.
Who knew that was such a trope?
Yeah, right? That should be our next episode. Books about stone carvers. Those might be the only two. It's hard to say. So if I ever really feel like crying, then maybe I'll pick that one up. But yes, thank you so much to Corinne, and thank you so much to Virginia and Liz as well for bringing their Canadian picks for us today. So just again, if you would like to participate in I Read Canadian Day, it is Wednesday, November the 8th. And the instructions, I suppose, are to read, engage with, be read to, listen to Canadian books for at least 15 minutes that day. If you would like more information, you can go to iReadCanadian.com, and they have all of the information there as well. All right. Well, thank you so much, everyone, for listening today. We will see you back next time for another episode of Keep It Fictional. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening. If you like our show, please tell a fellow book lover about it. You can find a list of all the books we discussed in our show notes. Join us next week for another fun book chat. Until then, keep it fictional.